12. Eliza watched as a small bee landed atop a lavender bush, the chosen sprig swaying under its buzzing weight. Birds chirped and tittered all around her, for the most part unseen from their assorted perches upon assorted branches, their cheerful songs never ceasing long enough to allow a moment of silence. The breeze was warm, the sun divine upon her skin, the heat of it filtering through her airy dress. Though Sara had selected a wealth of gorgeous articles for Aliza, she'd not known the girl's measurements, and as a result, most of the pieces were ill-fitting and would have to be altered. There were, however, a few in her size, alongside a wide array of undergarments of various dimensions available to her, and she'd been happy indeed to don fresh, clean things before finally stepping into the comfort of a soft, tissue-thin gown with long sleeves, hoping to protect the healing wounds along her left arm. She'd chosen an ivory number, the ethereal layers of chiffon offset by a weighty collar forged from a single gold cable that circled her neck and shoulders in cascading orbits, the precious metal halting its revolutions just below her breastbone. The neckband obscured an otherwise scandalously low neckline, where the delicate fabric crisscrossed firmly around the bodice before nipping in at her waist, below which it billowed out into a full skirt that fluttered in the wind. Her hair she'd tied up in her usual style, a mass of glossy curls pinned haphazardly atop her head. It was Sara who'd insisted she choose something from the prearranged allotment of jewels, and the options were so stunning it had taken little indeed to convince Aliza to do so. Still, she'd chosen to wear only a simple circlet in her hair, three whisper-thin gold bands hammered into a fine crown, a rainbow assortment of gems embedded throughout. Aliza glittered as she moved, as she pushed through the double doors that led to the lush green path she'd discovered upon arrival. It felt good to be clean, to reset. With the exception of her magical ball gown, it had been many years since Aliza had worn anything but the drab, serviceable garb of a servant, and despite the tragic circumstances, she was immensely grateful for the finery. Always she'd appreciated an artfully woven garment, but there was an even greater pleasure to be derived from the textile itself. Here, at least, her gowns would be fashioned from cloth so fine they'd never chafe or itch, never leave angry marks where the coarse seams scraped painfully against her skin during endless hours of labour. In a situation so bereft of mercies, she clung to this small gift, let it feed her starving heart. Aliza sighed, taking a sip from the cup of hot tea she'd carried with her into the garden. Earlier, Sara had summoned a servant to deliver a tray of comestibles and an assortment of beverages, and Aliza, who'd gratefully drunk her fill of water, had been surprised to discover that here too the servants wore snodders, masks of tulle that wrapped around the eyes and nose, softly blurring the wearer's features without impeding necessary vision. She'd been unable to look away from the young man who'd appeared, wraith-like, at the door. Aliza had been too mesmerized by the reminder of who she herself used to be, by how much in her life had changed in so short a time. As a servant, Aliza had always been grateful for her snodder, for the anonymity it provided, but she'd never forget how cruelly her caste had been treated, nor the injustices they were forced to endure. Aliza had whispered hello to the young snodder when he'd arrived, had offered him an encouraging smile. The boy had made a frightful sound in response, nearly dropping the tray as he hastened to set it down. After that, Sarah had given Aliza leave to rest. The older woman had reasoned that if Aliza stayed in her rooms, Cyrus would grow anxious to check on her, for he awaited her downstairs with great anticipation. Aliza should wait for him to come to her, Sarah had said, whereupon she should take advantage of the private moment, away from the wide eyes and perked ears of watching servants, to tell Cyrus she'd had a change of heart and to accept his proposal. Thinking it over now, Aliza felt a bit sick. It had been with a shocking reluctance that she'd agreed to Sarah's morbid arrangement. Shocking because, as Cyrus had so boldly accused Aliza earlier, she'd indeed been threatening to murder him for hours. That Aliza vacillated at all about killing him now was strange, for it should not have been so difficult a choice to make, certainly not under the current circumstances. Still, had Aliza decided to follow through with murdering the loathsome king under her own advisement, she'd never doubt the decision, for she trusted her judgment. But there was something about being asked to do it, something about being all but threatened to do it by decree of the young man's mother. It unnerved her. Something about it didn't sit right, and yet by her own admission, Aliza thought Cyrus a terrible, hateful king. His list of crimes was long and foul. She need not hesitate now, not because his mother had asked her rather aggressively to do what she'd already been planning to do anyway. No, surely not. If she killed Cyrus, she'd be free. She might flee. Kamran might be safe. The world might be spared another needless bloody war. And she might yet wriggle out of the devil's grip. Sarah had not lied when she'd made the girl a series of promises. Aliza had the Nosta to prove that. So why had the entire business left her so uneasy? Aliza's mind was muddled. She needed to assemble herself, to prepare for a tactical manoeuvre that would make her deeply uncomfortable, for Sarah had assured her that the easiest path to a man's murder was not forged with a weapon, but with unimpeachable kindness. "Forgive me, darling, but you'll never best him in battle," she'd said sympathetically. "I shouldn't try it if I were you." Aliza had protested at that, preparing to defend her many strengths, but Sarah only lifted a hand dismissively. "Oh, I'm sure you're quite capable. Noble, too. My son, on the other hand, will not fight fair. He's been studying sorcery and divination since he was old enough to toddle. He's exceedingly clever, rather deceptively strong, and lacks a basic standard of virtue. He's also very, very angry, and suspicious to a fault. He trusts no one. He won't take even a sip of water without having a servant taste it before him." She'd looked Aliza over. "Your unchecked anger makes you a clear threat, my dear. And for as long as you persist in this attitude, Cyrus will remain on guard. We must approach this from a position of strength," Sarah had said firmly. "And I believe your greatest strength might be something unexpectedly quiet. Convince him you genuinely wish to marry him, and once he ceases to suspect you of standing against him, you might then poison him over breakfast." Aliza had raised her eyebrows. She understood well the extenuating circumstances, but it was still hard to believe Sarah could discuss her son's murder with such nonchalance. "Or, you know, anything, really," Sarah had gone on, misunderstanding the look on Aliza's face. "You don't have to use poison. There are a number of ways to do it, all of which we can sort out after you've convinced him you mean no harm. This is the most important step, and we must get it right." Oh, it was too much. Aliza briefly closed her eyes now. rubbing at the tightness growing at the base of her neck. She sat down heavily at the table positioned just under the shade of a bower, her brows pulled together in frustration. Her head and heart felt heavy, her worries mounting. She was trapped in a foreign land, charged with a strange task by a strange woman. It seemed all who met Aliza possessed ulterior motives, whether to maim or manipulate or lie. Kamran, too, cherished as he was by her, had been dishonest from the start, and while of course she understood his reasons, it troubled her nonetheless that even the positive relationships in her life, Omid and Miss Huda, and even Dean the apothecarist among them, had all been born in some manner of unkindness. Aliza was grateful for the good in her life, really she was, but sometimes she longed for a joy undiluted. She wanted to know what it was to smile unhampered by darkness, to laugh without knowing the drumbeat of pain, to see friends without the shadow of uncertainty. What was uncomplicated happiness? She dearly wished to know. In all the years since her parents had died, there had been only one soul who from start to finish had been truly in her corner, Hazan. From the moment they'd met, Hazan had been steadfast, and now he was dead. The sudden heat in her eyes surprised her, even as the need to release this pain seemed somehow inevitable. She made a terrible sound, clapping a hand over her mouth to stifle the sob, even as tears fell fast down her face. With shaking fingers, she swiped at her cheeks, thinking of how Hazan had given up his life in the unmitigated pursuit of her protection, had taken chances for her without even knowing whether she was worthy. Even now she benefited from his generosity, the Noster having proven over and over to be the greatest gift she'd ever received, for without its guidance she'd have been well and truly lost. She sniffed and sent up a whisper of gratitude, wishing, as she struggled to fight back another wave of tears, that she'd had the chance to thank him while he was still alive. Hazan had believed in her. He'd offered up a blind faith in all that she was meant to be, in the queen her blood had crowned her, in the salvation promised her people, and in all that she'd never achieved. Were there others, Aliza wondered, who lived with the hope that she might save them? And if so, did she not owe it to them to give up her life in the unmitigated pursuit of their protection? How she wished her parents were still alive. If only they were here to help her, to show her the way. More than anything, Aliza found she wanted two things simultaneously: to go into a deep hibernation from which she might never emerge, and to rise up and become all that her people had ever hoped for. The problem with the latter option was both simple and tragic. She didn't know how. It was a general ignorance of the path she was meant to follow that had forced her into hiding in the first place. Prior to her 18th birthday, the event having occurred only several months ago, the power she'd been promised wouldn't have even opened to her, and now that she'd finally come of age, she couldn't access that which was hers. Five souls had to be willing to die for her before the magic would even reveal itself. And prior to that, she'd have to find the glorious substance, the location of which was a lost secret. All she knew was that the volatile minerals were buried deep in the Arya Mountains of Ardunia, and the only object that might have helped her pinpoint the precise location was now gone. When the fire had destroyed her family home and killed her mother, she'd managed to save her parents' handkerchief, which she'd tucked into the protection of her fireproof fist. Nothing else appeared to have survived. Metals and gold had been mutilated. All else had been reduced to ash. And yet, the morning after the horrific event, she'd seen a slim volume glinting in the rays of a rising sun, beckoning her close, even as her heart shattered in her chest. It was no book she'd ever seen before. This one object had endured the blaze entirely on its own, and, much like Eliza herself, the object in question had proven impervious to fire. Eliza had known unequivocally that the book was meant for her. It had seemed to beckon her. She'd approached the gleaming hardback cautiously, understanding even then that her parents must have hidden it from her on purpose. Eliza had been but 13 when her world had gone up in flames, and though her mother and father had by then told her who she was meant to be, had prepared her in so many other ways for the role, they hadn't wanted to burden her in childhood with the weight of every truth. They'd told her their intentions, that they meant to withhold certain information so that she might enjoy her youth a while longer. They'd promised to tell her everything when she came of age. At 18, they'd never had the chance. In their absence all these years, that enigmatic book had been her only guide. It was a tattered, unspectacular object that didn't draw attention to itself, but which was quietly magicked. It offered what appeared to be but the first clue in a cryptic puzzle, one Eliza had long ago memorized, but as yet had been unable to decipher. Still, she'd clung to this small offering, protecting the enchanted volume as best as a destitute servant was able to protect their few possessions. Not until this moment had Eliza allowed herself to think about the misplacement of her carpet bag, the important artifacts of her entire life, lost, no doubt forever. That she'd lost her mother's handkerchief was hard enough, but this, it was yet another blow, another devastation. Eliza wiped again at her damp face, clutching the cup of tea like a lifeline. She'd left the drink untouched for so long it was likely cold now, but she didn't mind. Flowering vines released a heavenly fragrance into the air around her, and she did her utmost to focus on the delicious scent, closing her eyes as she steadied her breathing, taking a sip of the lukewarm tea and savouring it. "You changed." Eliza startled so badly, she spilled the drink down the front of her clean white dress, gasping as the liquid soaked through the thin fabric, cold tea dripping steadily down her chest. She shot to her feet in a fury. Cyrus, on the other hand, was sitting calmly in the chair across from her, his iconic black hat nowhere in sight. His eyes shone a bright, mesmerizing blue against the golden warmth of his skin, the waves of his coppery hair glinting in errant streaks of sun, the resultant sheen making the locks seem almost metallic. He was infuriatingly beautiful, and she nearly threw her teacup at him. "You absolute heathen!" she cried. "Why did you not knock?" "I did," he said, and spoke his next words slowly, as if she were a child. "But you couldn't have heard, because you were sitting all the way out here." Eliza's grip tightened around the empty glass in her hand. "And it didn't occur to you that perhaps I wished to be alone?"
"No."
He tilted his head, a strange little smile touching his lips.
"My mother told me you were waiting for me. She said you wished to speak with me on a matter of great importance."
Eliza had to close her eyes then, pressing her lips firmly shut, lest she say something brutal about Cyrus's family and ruin this new, kinder approach she was meant to take. Sarah was proving to be a real trial, and Eliza thought she might hate them both.
"Forgive me," said Cyrus quietly. "But do you intend to make it a habit of wearing transparent garments in my presence? Do tell me now, I beg you, so that I might blind myself in anticipation." Eliza opened her eyes, a quiet rage building in her chest, even as her battered dignity demanded she blush. "How dare you?" she whispered.
"It's only that I can see straight through the front of your dress," he said, gesturing vaguely at her body. "And I'm beginning to see that this is a pattern with you."
It demanded everything of her self-control not to clobber him over the head with her teacup. Eliza welcomed the feeling, stowing it away as ammunition for the unsavoury task of murdering him at a more opportune time. She summoned all that Sara had said to her, reminding herself that this madman had killed his own father, murdered a team of diviners, slaughtered the king of Ardunia, and heavens knew what else. He'd likely committed any number of truly heinous acts. Eliza presented all this as evidence to her unshrinking mind, assuring herself quite firmly that she ought to be afraid of Cyrus. She ought to treat him with the utmost caution, not shout at him as if he were some mutton-headed boy, for he was in fact a powerful, forbidding king that might lop off her head with little inducement. And yet, even as she scolded herself, she failed then to feel the terror the situation demanded. The problem was, she did not feel unequal to him. It was perhaps a dangerous conviction, but Eliza felt quite certain she could manage him. Two, Cyrus did not strike her then as truly monstrous, which should have been alarming in and of itself, but it was hard to maintain such a position when she failed to feel fear in his presence. None of this made sense, of course, for when she listed his evils in her head, he cut a truly despicable character. It was possible, she allowed, that the excruciating events of the last 24 hours had irreparably addled her mind. In any case, her task was to kill Cyrus, quite literally, with kindness, a stratagem that, however distasteful, might save her and spare innocent lives by avoiding a bloody war. This tactic would not work if she allowed herself to be so easily riled by him, and if she did not cease these childish, angry reactions to every minor provocation, she would no doubt live to regret it. So she smiled. She sat back down in her wet dress, dropped an elbow onto the table, her cheek into her hand, and smiled. She put a great deal into the effort, too, recalling her happiest memories until the smile was no longer forced, but genuine. "No," she said politely, all trace of anger gone from her voice. "I do not intend to make it a habit. And I'm glad you've come. There's a great deal we must discuss." Cyrus did not hide his surprise. She thought he might look away from her unbridled smile. Instead, he studied her with visible fascination, turning fully in his seat to face her. He said nothing even as his eyes fairly glimmered with mirth. Watching her for so long, she nearly gave up the effort, all the while ignoring the way her heart reacted to the full force of his attentions. It was impossible to deny. There was something physically potent about Cyrus, a powerful presence he carried with him into every moment. He looked at her then with a focus so complete she felt she might buckle under its weight, and tried not to think about why her breaths seemed to come a bit faster, her heart pounding a bit harder, when his lashes lowered, his gaze falling to her lips for a moment too long. She felt trapped.
"Eliza," he said softly, "have you been a wicked girl?"
Abruptly, she drew away from the table and hugged herself, her wet gown chilling her anew in the breeze. "No," she said too quickly, realizing that, in fact, she might have underestimated the southern king. Never averting his eyes, Cyrus mirrored her earlier movements. He dropped an elbow onto the table, his cheek into his hand, and blinded her with a smile so sincere it unsettled her, inciting an unexpected, detestable flutter of feeling in her chest. "No," he said, still smiling. Not trusting herself to speak, she shook her head.
"God, you're so beautiful," he said, his smile vanishing. "Even when you lie to me."
His admission awoke a flare of heat in her veins, a reaction she didn't understand and was afraid to analyze. She knew not why he'd say such a thing to her, nor why his words had made any impact, and she didn't want to think on it. She knew only that Cyrus's eyes had darkened with an emotion she was afraid to name, and she had no idea what he was going to say next. She was realizing she never did. Cyrus stood up suddenly, stepped closer, towered over her. He all but blotted out the light with his height, casting her in shadow, causing her to shiver in the absence of the sun. He touched her then, shocking her with a tenderness she wasn't expecting, tracing the line of her jaw so lightly, her lips parted on a sudden breath. She couldn't seem to move. Her body had betrayed her. Her body had betrayed her, even as her mind screamed.
"Wicked girl," he whispered. "You've been making deals with my mother."
13.
"You gave my job to the child?"
Hazan threw open the door to the war room with an unchecked anger that was beginning to feel familiar. The former minister had bathed and changed. He'd not been imprisoned long enough to have lost his rooms and belongings, so it was with some efficiency that he was able to return to a semblance of normal. With one great exception.
"Omid saved my life," Kamran said without looking up.
He sat in the war room alone, drinking tea as he paged through a fresh stack of reports from the different reaches of the Empire.
"Yes, so you said, though I'd not realized he'd relieved you of your good sense in the process. Did you know?"
Kamran said, lifting a sheaf of paper as he scanned it.
"That in recent months, there have been a dozen reports of unexplained avalanches in 3 different mountain ranges across the Empire."
Hazan ignored this as he strode into the room, slamming the door shut behind him.
"You hired an uneducated 12-year-old to succeed me, and you expect me not to take offence? As if my job were so simple, and I so easily replaced?"
Kamran put down the papers.
"Do you not think it strange?"
"Strange is too gentle a word. I think it verifiably crack-brained."
"Not the situation with the child, you fool. The unexplained rock slides."
Again, Kamran glanced at the report. 4 in the last month alone, though our troops have found nary a trace of explosives. By all accounts, the occurrences in the Istanes, Pune, and Sotun Mountains are random disturbances of nature, which I was happy enough to accept until this morning, when, just as I was contemplating the astonishing devolution of my life," he said with a wry smile, "2 more were reported. With the recent inrush of Tulanian spies, I can't help but wonder whether there's more to this than we previously considered. Perhaps they've been hiding out in the mountains, making a bit of a mess in the process. Perhaps there have been other rockfalls in more remote regions with no witnesses, making the real number much higher. What do you think?"
"I think you're a righteous ass."
"Throw a fit if you like," Kamran said, setting the papers aside to take another drink of his tea.
"But I'm not firing the boy. In the last several hours, he's already proven quite capable."
"Capable?" Hazan's eyes widened.
"Capable of what? Snatching purses? Emptying out the treasure houses?
Have you even thought to make certain your gold is still there?
I will allow, said Kamran, lightly clearing his throat, that I was perhaps not entirely in my right mind when I made the decision. Still, I would argue that your judgments of the child are too reductive. In my estimation, Omid has proven a great deal less conniving than the members of our own parliament. The nobles of the seven houses will likely never change, but with proper guidance, the boy might yet make something of himself.
And I? What am I meant to make of myself?
I intend to confer knighthood upon you.
Hazan scoffed in anger, preparing to argue, when he realized with a visible shock that Kamran had spoken in earnest.
You wish to make me a knight? He said, stunned. But I'm not even a soldier.
I have proof enough of your valour, Hazan. The former minister fell back, fell silent. He stared for a moment at the floor as a rare heat burned across his cheekbones, the tips of his ears.
And I have full confidence, Kamran said, returning to his papers, in your ability to storm a battlefield.
You are not yet king, Hazan looked up, his tone still betraying a stubborn scepticism. Do you even have the power to do such a thing?
Are you trying to offend me? Said Kamran, a shadow of a smile touching his lips. I've always possessed such a power. Though as imminent heir to an empty throne, I do have more authority now than I did yesterday, and I find I'm eager to exercise these rights before they're taken away. And what does that entail?
First, I must tell you that you were right, Kamran said, rising from his chair. In your absence, I learned that the nobles have already assembled a new royal court of diviners, who should be arriving steadily throughout the day. The last of them will be here by nightfall. They are to stay here at the palace while their rooms are readied at the diviners' quarters. They won't be leaving until after all the funerals take place, over the next couple of days.
Zahak told you this?
Kamran's eyes narrowed.
Zahak wouldn't tell me if a sword were inches from my throat. He still thinks me an ignorant child, unworthy of my father's throne.
A shame, isn't it, that you've never given him reason to think otherwise?
Shut up, Hazan.
Hazan only smiled.
The lords of the seven houses did all this in relative secrecy, Kamran went on. I only found out from Jamshid, who needed my sign-off on the repairs for the palace, and who wished to express aloud his pleasure that the protections around the empire would be back in place as soon as our quorum of diviners had fully settled.
You will also be fascinated to hear that Jamshid, our dear palace butler, is better informed than I on more than one salient issue. For when I asked him whether he'd seen my mother, he rather cheerfully told me she'd be home in a matter of days.
Hazan blinked.
Your mother has fled the palace?
When?
Not after she buried her dagger in your arm?
Impeccable timing on her part. I'm afraid she has a fantastically warped idea of what constitutes maternal affection.
And you don't know where she's gone?
I haven't the faintest.
When I asked, Jamshid claimed she'd gone to fetch me a gift in honour of my impending coronation.
Kamran then raised his eyebrows at Hazan.
Hazan mirrored the expression.
A vial of poison, then?
My thoughts exactly, said the prince, a reluctant smile tugging at his lips.
It really is a great comfort to me that you are not dead this morning, Hazan.
It is a great comfort to me as well, sire, Hazan said dryly.
Kamran began stacking his papers, moving things aside to make room on the table, and though his smile diminished, it did not fade altogether. His life was falling apart at the seams, but he'd managed to prove wrong his mother's last ominous words. If Zahak were to have his way,
Kamran might never haunt the halls of this palace again, but at least, wherever he landed, he would not walk alone. He'd come to the stunning realization that he'd rather be falling apart with friends than living a decadent life of isolation. "Whatever my mother's gone to do," he went on, "I cannot begin to imagine, for the turns of her mind are impossible to predict. The only thing I know for certain is that she will be sorry indeed to return, for upon arrival she will discover the palace is no longer her home. I've concluded I have at most a day before the houses cobble together reason enough to strip me of my title, and less than a week before Zahak usurps my throne, which means we must work quickly."
"We?" Hazan balked. "You and I are meant to save the Ardunian Empire all alone, then? And where is the child who stole my job?"
"The child is occupied.
With what?"
"Bringing me witnesses."
"What for, you exasperating half-wit?" Hazan threw up his hands. "Are you so incapable of anticipating that I might want more than the paltry monosyllabic responses you serve?"
"Heavens, you sound almost hungry."
Hazan sighed, searching the room as if for patience. "Do you know," he said finally, "it's just occurred to me that I no longer have to pretend to own an appetite at regular intervals. A small but rather delightful gain of all this perfidy, for I find eating meals an exhausting waste of time."
Kamran raised his eyebrows. "Speaking of gin, I don't understand," he said, reaching underneath the large table and unearthing the forgotten carpet bag. "I take it you know who this belongs to." The prince dropped the luggage onto a newly cleared section of the polished wood, still managing to send papers scattering in the process. Hazan only stared at him. "In the dungeons earlier," Kamran explained, "I saw you studying it, as if it looked familiar to you."
Hesitantly, Hazan said, "I'm not certain of the owner. I have only an unsubstantiated theory."
"Go on."
"I think it belongs to Aliza."
Kamran gripped the table, anticipating pain, and instead he felt only a gentle heat, a flutter in his chest, a heavenly fragrance filling his head. He hadn't realized he'd squeezed his eyes shut until he forced them open and was met with a look of astonishment on Hazan's face. Slowly, Kamran released the table.
"How?" he said, clearing his throat. "Do you know it belongs to her?"
Hazan only gaped at him.
"What just happened to you?"
"Nothing," he sighed. "I don't know. Just don't say her name again."
"Who? Aliza?
Bastard," Kamran muttered, as renewed feeling lanced through him, birdsong filling his head, a warm, not unpleasant sensation sparking along the disfigured lines of his neck, his cheek, his changed eye.
"You did that on purpose."
"I swear I didn't," said Hazan quietly, studying Kamran closely now.
"I don't understand. You can't hear her name without experiencing, what, pain?"
The feeling was slowly abating, and Kamran drew a steadying breath as he shook his head.
"It's not always pain. I feel different things each time, and it only started this morning. You don't happen to know what's wrong with me?"
"I'm afraid not," said Hazan, concern etching his forehead. "But if she has some kind of hold on you from so far away, only a powerful magic can be involved. I know little more than that." Kamran fell silent, recalling the way he still felt when he thought of her, the way some chamber of his heart thrashed against his better judgment, demanding to see her, to speak with her despite everything, and could not help but agree. He took a sharp breath. There was no use in thinking of their time together. If he thought too long about the tears she'd shed in his presence, the fears she'd exposed, the smiles she'd shared. No! Some baser part of his mind wanted desperately to find reasons to exonerate her, and he refused to be so weak. The only way to armour himself was to forget the brief moments they'd had. He refused to remember the softness of her lips, refused to recall the way she'd surrendered to his touch, the sound she'd made when he'd kissed her. She'd looked into his eyes like he was worth something, had touched him like he might be precious. Her soft curves had fit perfectly in his hands, against his body. He'd wanted to unravel her slowly, strip her down to nothing, press his face to her heated skin and live there, devour her. He'd never admit aloud that he'd done as much in his dreams, losing himself in her over and over, only to wake in a fevered, painful state of frustration. She had gouged a hole in him from which he feared he'd never recover. Not once in his life had he felt such a powerful attraction to anyone. He'd never even known a kiss was capable of such power. Kamran?
Yes.
The single word was breathless. Where did you go?
Nowhere,
he said unsteadily. He took another ragged breath, his body tense. When he looked up, he stared only at the wall.
Let us focus for the moment on the questions we can answer. How did you know this bag belonged to her?
I saw her carrying it, said Hazan, the night she was to be murdered by the king.
That cleared Kamran's head in an instant. He looked sharply at Hazan, his brows pulling together.
So my grandfather was right, he said. She did have help. It was you who assisted her in defeating those ruffians.
Not at all, Hazan laughed. She did that entirely on her own. I only watched her from the shadows, waiting to intervene should she need assistance, which she never did.
He shook his head.
Your grandfather was so convinced she'd had access to a complex arsenal, when in fact she'd murdered those men with little more than her own sewing supplies.
These, you mean?
Kamran turned the bag on its side, dumping its contents in a contained scatter across the table. Among them was a small silky pillow and matching quilt, cases of pins and needles, scissors, spools of thread, salves and strips of linen from the apothecary, small bags containing various notions, gilded scrolls inviting her to the royal ball, a number of heavy faded garments.
Where did you get this? Hazan said, dumbstruck.
He stared at the table, then at Kamran, then back again.
How did you get your hands on her things?
Miss Huda delivered the luggage to me this morning.
The daughter of the Lojan ambassador?
Hazan frowned.
The screaming one from last night, with the candelabra?
Kamran nodded. She thought its contents might be helpful to me in my search.
He relayed to Hazan the information Miss Huda had shared with him that morning, all about the magical shoes, the dress, how Cyrus had appeared as if from nowhere in her room at Follard Place, how he'd threatened to kill her before whisking them all away to the ball without notice, where Miss Huda had arrived terrified and without a voice.
Your queen left behind her bag by accident, Kamran said archly. She hadn't time to take it with her.
Hazan, who'd gone silent during the explanation, was now frowning.
But I thought the two of them were on good terms. Why would Miss Huda wish to assist in the capture of her friend?
So you knew then, said Kamran, irritated in a flash. You knew she worked as a seamstress, in addition to being a snodder?
Hazan shot him an imperious look.
Naturally, he said. When I learned of her existence, I uncovered all I could about her.
And you didn't think to tell me?
As you will recall, sire, I was at the time withholding a great deal of information from you. For the love of God, Hazan, he said with a sigh, do cease being useless to me. I promise to consider it. Miss Huda only wants us to find the girl, Kamran pressed on, because she thinks the Tulanian king might do something terrible. She claims to be worried about her. Hazan raised his eyebrows. I see I have an unexpected ally in Miss Huda, then. Kamran wanted to make a quip, to name them allies only in idiocy, but he found he could not make his mouth form the necessary words. He'd never wanted to hate Aliza, and he'd be lying if he said the collective opinions of those around him were not beginning to destabilize his convictions on the matter. Still, the evidence stacked against her was damning and confusing. Very little of note inside, he muttered. I've already searched everything thrice, broken open the seams of the pillow and quilt, turned pockets inside out, studied even the most minuscule items for evidence of anything. He looked up, his apprehension spiking as he spoke, recalling the many discrepancies in her character, her actions, the prophecy itself. She doesn't own a single weapon. As I've already told you, Hazan said flatly, she has no aspirations to topple any empire. What reason would she have to stockpile weapons? The inconsistency is not lost on me, Hazan, he said quietly. But then, there is something else, too. From within the depths of the overturned bag, Kamran retrieved a slim, cloth-bound volume, the rough size and shape of a novel, which he slid across the table toward Hazan. What do you make of this? Said the prince. The cloth cover was worn and faded. What was once a bright blue was now washed out, nearly grey. The blank pages were stiff and waterlogged, the book warped by time and moisture. Hazan studied it without a word, looking grim about the mouth as he did, and when Kamran flipped the book over so his friend might read the inscription on the back, Hazan drew a sharp breath. In faded gold letters it read, Melt the ice in salt, braid the thrones at sea. In this woven kingdom, clay and fire shall be. 14. Aliza remembered herself a moment too late, jerking away from Cyrus's hand with the shock that she'd allowed him to touch her at all. She studied him warily in the intervening silence, his eyes as startling as her own, her heart pounding in her chest with a delayed fear. Aliza had been wrong. She could not manage him. She had been wrong, too, to underestimate him. Always, Cyrus seemed to be one step ahead of her, and somehow she knew it would not do to lie to him now, for he seemed preternaturally attuned to deception. It made her wonder whether he owned a Noster too. What did my mother convince you to do? He said quietly, tilting his head as he took her in. Did she ask you to kill me? Aliza could hardly mask her astonishment. The fact that he might guess at Sara's dark, decidedly unnatural intentions was alarming and crowded her head with only more confusion. How twisted was the tale of his family, and what was this trap she'd walked into? How many players were in this game? Or did you think, he said, impatience edging into his voice, that I was unaware of my mother's barely concealed hatred for me? Oh, she'd been so sure of herself only moments ago, so certain she was not afraid of him. She felt terrified now. Aliza! Yes, she said breathlessly. I agreed to kill you in exchange for my freedom. Something flashed in and out of his eyes at her admission, and she could have sworn it was something like pain. But then he took a sharp breath and straightened, his sardonic smile firmly back in place as he looked over her head, stared into the distance. Aliza took that opportunity to bolt. She shot up from her chair and dashed down the path with supernatural speed, trying to form a plan as she went. She wasn't sure what purpose it might serve to flee, but she couldn't imagine he'd take kindly to her confession. And while she wasn't sure what he planned to do about it, she could only imagine his mind would resolve to do something bloody. If his mother was right about him, and it appeared that she was, and Aliza would certainly lose to him in a fight of force, which she suspected she might, then she had no choice but to run. "Aliza!" he cried. She barreled through the double doors that opened onto her bedroom, but only after slamming them shut did she discover they didn't lock, and in the moments she spent trying to bolt the blasted doors, she saw him fast closing the distance between them, his long legs carrying him along the grassy path at an impressive clip. She abandoned the door just as he tore it open. He was right behind her now, following as she darted uselessly through the serpentine space, preternatural swiftness proving useless to her as she turned in circles, realizing too late that she still didn't know the layout of this room well enough to locate the exit with efficiency. "I'm not going to hurt you," he called out, frustrated. "How many times do I have to tell you that I can't kill you before you actually believe me?" She halted at that, her crazed mind devouring the reminder as the Noster burned against her skin. It was no wonder she couldn't decide whether to fear him. It was obvious now why she wavered so much on the subject, why she struggled to feel danger in his presence. Her instincts were not addled. It was only that he'd been ordered by the devil not to harm her. She had some kind of immunity. Aliza spun around, the movement so fast that Cyrus, who'd been chasing after her, didn't have time to process the change. He abruptly crashed into her, sending them both hurtling before they finally slammed together, him pinning her to the wall so hard she gasped, air leaving her lungs in a rush. Aliza froze. She was trapped under the unexpected weight of him, the crush of his hard body, the column of his throat a mere inch from her mouth. His closeness was so overpowering it dulled her senses, slowed her mind. He was a heavy wall of heat, his dark masculine scent overwhelming her, activating some ancient response that made her heart race. At least he too appeared stunned, and in the milliseconds during which their minds caught up to their bodies, he'd lowered his eyes, nailing her in place with a look that liquefied her bones. She didn't know if what she felt in his presence was fear or anticipation, but either one seemed cause for concern. She only knew that the anger he conjured a moment later belied the hitch in his breath, the tremble in his body. She watched him swallow as he slowly drew away, his hands sliding off the wall where he'd planted them. He moved back, but not nearly enough. "I hate you," he whispered. Aliza blinked, her heart pounding too hard in her chest. "I know." He leaned in then, his throat working, his gaze fixed entirely on her mouth. "I hate everything about you. Your eyes, your lips, your smile." His words grazed her skin when he said, softly, "I find your presence insufferable." The Noster flared hot against her sternum. "Okay," she said again, her pulse skyrocketing. "That's okay." He was still breathing hard, his chest heaving between them. "But I'm not going to hurt you." Again the Noster verified his words, and Aliza felt some of the pressure ease in her lungs. "Do you believe me?" he asked. Aliza nodded. He was so close, his eyes so firmly fixed on her face, that she wasn't sure she'd have noticed the surprise flit in and out of his features otherwise. It was clear he hadn't expected her to agree, to trust him. He couldn't have known that he'd been right to doubt her, for what she trusted was not him, but the Nosta. Still, a degree of tension seemed to leave his body, relief prompting him to finally step back. He looked shaken as he turned away, staring at the wall, the ceiling, the floor, anywhere but at her face. When he met her eyes again, his were bright with unvarnished feeling.
"I need you," he said roughly. "Don't run away from me."
"How can you expect me not to run from you?" said Aliza, still trying to shake off her apprehension. "When you threatened just hours ago to have my eyes sewn shut." He looked sharply away from her then, a muscle jumping in his jaw.
"I shouldn't have said that."
"And then you threw me off a cliff," she said, her voice a bit breathless, even to her own ears.
"You wouldn't stop threatening to kill me," he said angrily, turning back to face her. "I was merely trying to change the subject."
"By having me devoured by dragons?" she nearly cried. Cyrus scoffed at that, arching a brow.
"You were never devoured by dragons."
"I was too," she shot back. "Your little joke resulted in some nasty bites all along my left side. Your mother was kind enough to mix me a medicinal bath."
Cyrus studied her then with an inscrutable expression. She thought he might demand to see proof of her injuries, but he said only,
"Dragons are gentle creatures. They don't bite unless provoked."
"Well," said Aliza, averting her eyes. She was feeling petulant, and there was only so much eye contact with Cyrus she could handle. "I don't think the animal meant to bite me, but I was rolled onto its back teeth with rather gruesome results." She felt, rather than saw, Cyrus go suddenly still, and for the length of a wild, charged moment, she thought he might do something unhinged, like apologize. Instead, he said,
"You seem well enough now."
"I'm fine," she said, irritated.
"Good."
"And I'm not sorry," she added bitterly, turning to face him. "I'm not sorry I made a deal with your mother to murder you." His lips twitched, his eyes flashing.
"I'm not sorry I threw you off a cliff."
"Excellent," she said, matching his anger. He only smiled in response. Aliza tried to steady herself, to calm her chaotic heart. She didn't know what was happening here between them, but whatever it was making her wary. She and Cyrus were no longer speaking to each other like mortal enemies. Instead, they were tolerating each other with an ounce of civility. It was almost as if they'd, inadvertently, initiated a reluctant truce. She didn't trust it. Still, she was beginning to believe there had to be more to Cyrus than the stories she'd heard, than even the horrors his mother had described, for it was becoming clearer by the minute that he was a character more complicated than she'd expected. She studied him as he began to pace, as he dragged a hand through his hair, mussing the copper locks in a show of agitation, and was forced to wonder why someone so young and intelligent and capable, someone who by his mother's own admission had grown up beloved by his parents and had the beauty of Tulan and its people at his disposal. "Cyrus," she said suddenly. He halted at once, meeting her eyes.
"Why exactly did you make a deal with the devil?"
Cyrus blinked slowly, visibly thrown by her question.
"I thought you didn't care," he said. "I thought you said I was no doubt suffering the consequences of my own sins."
"And are you not?"
This he didn't answer, not at first. He seemed to be assessing her,
deciding whether she was worth an honest response, before he said, quietly,
"I was desperate and stupid."
The Noster agreed with this, and Aliza took a tentative step closer. "Why were you desperate?" Cyrus laughed, but there was an ache in it, a tension in his smile, in the lines of his body. He locked eyes with her, holding her entirely in his thrall before he said, in a softly lilting voice,
"Should you choose to tell her why, you'll only ruin all my fun. Soon thereafter you shall die, bit by bit, and both are done."
Aliza felt the grip of a familiar terror.
"Iblis," she breathed.
"Yes," he said quietly.
"What does he mean, bit by bit and both are done?"
Cyrus only shook his head.
"Right," Aliza said, wringing her hands. "You can't say."
She searched the room then with a vague panic, as if it might offer her answers. Aliza understood too well how awful it was to be trapped by the devil, and her intimate knowledge of such a situation inspired in her a begrudging commiseration. Cyrus's actions were being choreographed by a master planner. He was but a useful puppet in a larger scheme. The difference was, Cyrus had summoned the beast into his life, while Aliza had only ever been a luckless victim. No doubt some weakness of the flesh had prompted Cyrus to bring these tortures upon himself. She could only imagine what he'd wanted in exchange. His pains, she reminded herself, were not her problem. His mess was not hers to manage.
"I realize," she said calmly, "that you're in a terrible predicament. I think I can understand why you need me. And while I empathize, more than I'd like, with your situation, I cannot and will not wittingly become a pawn in the plans of the devil. He is the most abhorrent of living beings, and personally responsible for the ruination of my people, for the pain they continue to endure today. I've spent my entire life trying to outrun his abiding interest in me, and I don't intend to stop now. And while, yes, you might need me," she went on, "I feel it necessary to point out here that I require nothing from you. I derive no benefit from helping you, only harm."
"What if," he took a deep, measured breath, "what if I made it worth your while?"
"What? How?"
"My mother offered you a deal, which you accepted," he said. "I'll offer you a better one."
She gaped at him. "You're asking me to double-cross your mother? Heavens, but you're a very strange family."
"Marry me," Cyrus said, a spark of heat in his eyes. "Become my queen just long enough to sate the devil's demands. Once he's satisfied, he'll discharge me of a tremendous debt, and I'll be that much closer to my freedom. When I'm finally free, I give you leave to kill me at your leisure and take Tulan for yourself."
Aliza stiffened, disbelief roaring through her, even as the Noster burned hot against her chest.
"You can't be serious," she breathed.
"My kingdom," he said softly, "for your hand."
15.
"Do you know what it means?" Kamran asked. Hazan shook his head. He picked up the book with a reverence evident in his eyes, his hands, in the stillness of his features. Carefully he flipped through its blank pages, then studied the cover with his fingers, searching its skin for something. "There," he said softly, pressing down on something along the spine.
"Just there."
"What is it?"
"A faint embossing," he said. "It's a symbol, quite old."
Kamran took the book in his own hands, searching the spine.
When he found the mark in question, he frowned. It was the outline of two triangles side by side and interlocked, a third triangle forming where they overlapped, with a single wavy line underscoring it all.
What does it mean? Arya.
Kamran froze, then slowly lifted his head, meeting Hazan's eyes.
Like the mountain range, in the north.
Hazan nodded, his eyes inscrutable.
Have you ever been?
No.
It's brutal up there. Blistering cold like you've never experienced. And a snowfall that never ceases, reducing visibility near to nothing.
It was the home of my ancestors, Hazan said quietly. It was where the Jinn built their first kingdom after the fall of Iblis. It's been whispered among us that the Arya Mountains hold a powerful magic, accessible only by the true sovereign of the land. But most think it's only an old story, for no one in documented history has ever found evidence of such a magic.
And you?
Kamran tensed as he studied his friend.
Do you think it's an old story?
Hazan hesitated, taking a breath before saying softly,
No.
Kamran dropped the book on the table, watching it land with a dull thud.
Heavens, he whispered. That's what they've been doing here. All these Tulanian spies, all these months.
He shook his head, looked up.
I was wrong, Hazan. War will not solve our problem with Tulan. In fact, I'm starting to think it will make things worse. How do you figure that?
Kamran briefly squeezed his eyes shut, muttered a foul word under his breath.
Because, he said, it seems so obvious now that war is what they want. All this time they've been goading us.
I don't follow your logic. Why would they goad us into war? If they want war, they might launch a preemptive strike of their own if they were to invade our borders, Kamran said, frustrated.
They'd be fighting us on our own land. An ant challenging a lion to a duel. Ardunia is enormous. Our bases spread generously across the empire, our soldiers numbering in the hundreds of thousands. It'd be a suicide mission.
Hazan visibly tensed, understanding dawning in his eyes. But if we were to engage in a land war on their territory,
exactly, said Kamran. Our soldiers would be compelled to leave their posts. Ardunia's forces would be fractured, our priorities rearranged, our troops diverted, our empire far less guarded as a result. Tulan would take full advantage of our distraction to plunder the Arya Mountains at their leisure, striking us where we'd least expect it. They'd sustain great losses in the process. But if this magic you speak of truly exists, their reward would be great indeed. Several thousand lives lost in exchange for untold, unknown magical power? It would certainly be worthwhile to someone like Cyrus.
Hazan looked a bit shell-shocked.
All these recent offences,
Kamran shook his head.
Hazan, you know as well as I do that neither of our empires is allowed to use destructive magic at the border. And in all our years of discord with Tulan, they've respected this, never breaking the Nyx Convention. But during the last water journey, our ship was nearly overturned upon impact with a magical barrier. This alone should have been cause for retaliation, but despite my protests, our officials would not see reason.
Yes, said Hazan dryly. I can imagine how they struggled to see your point when you convoluted the issue by insulting them, suggesting that our exchanges with Tulan had become as familiar to them as their own bowel movements.
Kamran silenced Hazan with a dark look, choosing to ignore this proof of his recent stupidity. In the last 2 years, he said instead, we've detained 65 Tulanian spies, more than half of whom we intercepted in the last 8 months alone. But spies have been infiltrating our borders for centuries,
Did they suddenly forget the definition of stealth? Why would they be so sloppy now? It's almost as if they wanted to get caught. Hazan took on a shrewd look. And then, of course, there is the small matter of your grandfather.
Precisely, Kamran said, his own eyes narrowing. It was you who pointed out that never in all these years of peacetime had a Tulanian king accepted an invitation to one of our balls.
Hazan drew a deep breath, releasing it slowly before he said,
It goes without saying that killing and disgracing the sovereign of a neighbouring empire are grounds for immediate retaliation.
And yet, a muscle ticked in Kamran's jaw, our officials continued to hesitate.
It doesn't compute.
Hazan, said the prince, I smell a rat.
A rat?
Hazan looked up, surprised.
But wouldn't a rat aim to fulfill Tulan's desires?
If, as you posit, Tulan is goading us into war, would not the guilty official have pounced eagerly upon any one of these opportunities to strike back?
Kamran hesitated.
Maybe our rat is awaiting new intelligence.
Who?
Zahak?
I don't...
No, Kamran said, his focus drifting as he remembered something his grandfather had told him just yesterday. He couldn't believe it was yesterday. But Zal had confessed to putting off war with Tulan all these years, only for Kamran's benefit, to spare him the loss of another parent, an immature ascension to the throne, a childhood forged in war. But the late king was also the first to confirm, despite the reticence of all the other nobles, that war with Tulan was absolute. It was, in fact, one of the last things King Zal had said to the prince.
War is coming, he'd whispered. It has been a long time coming. I only hope I've not left you unprepared to face it.
Kamran found his nerves would not settle after that. Some unspoken unease had come alive in his body like a warning, as if the last of his grandfather's betrayals had yet to reveal itself.
I'm not sure, Hazan was saying, his steady voice pulling the prince free of his reverie.
I'd like to believe Zahak is a rat. He fairly looks like one. But I've also known him too long. He's been brutally loyal to Ardunia for decades. He paused, his brows pulling together. When did you say we began to intercept the bulk of the spies? Several months ago?
Kamran took a sharp breath, regrouped, and nodded. I was on a tour of duty the first time we brought a cluster in for questioning. It was fairly unprecedented to capture so many at once, and we'd foolishly congratulated ourselves on a job well done. This was 7-8 months ago. Cyrus took the throne 8 months ago.
The prince's jaw clenched.
You think they were under his orders to be captured? Or do you think Cyrus has been doing reconnaissance?
Both. The other rockfalls you've been reading about. Perhaps they were distractions. Decoys to divert our attention from their true aim.
Hazan shook his head.
Perhaps Cyrus was deluded enough to think he'd be recognised as the true sovereign of the land, that Arya would open its arms to him. But if he spent months searching the mountains with no success, it follows that he'd then seek out someone who might be able to possess it. And if the stories are true, there's only one person alive for whom the Arya Mountains will give up its secrets.
The lost queen of Arya, Kamran whispered.
Hazan stilled.
Where did you hear that?
She told me, Kamran said, remembering.
She said her name was Aliza of Sam, daughter of Siavosh and Kiana, that I might know her better as the lost queen of Arya.
Hazan took a step closer, studying Kamran now with a renewed focus.
Why would she tell you that?
Because I asked her. I'd wanted to know her name. Was this when you went to Bar's house? When you were meant to search her rooms and claimed you'd found them empty? Kamran, who was perturbed by the look on Hazan's face, considered lying, but didn't see the point.
Yes, he said. Angels above, Hazan said quietly, horror awakening in his eyes.
You kissed her, didn't you?
Kamran felt uneasy now. Why does that matter?
Hazan turned sharply away, pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes. How can you not understand? He all but exploded as he spun around. She is the hope of an entire civilization. She is not some girl to be trifled with, to pass the hours on a dull day.
You misunderstand me, Kamran said sharply.
If you think I ever... I should call you out right now, you arrogant bastard, for treating her so poorly, that you'd ever dally with her and discard her. I did not dally with her. You speak of killing her. I would have married her, Kamran cried.
Hazan stiffened at that, his features frozen in a strange shock.
You lie.
Kamran laughed, laughed like he'd lost all reason.
I only wish I were. I wish I felt nothing for her. I wish I could rip this useless organ out of my chest for all the trouble it's caused me. I was so deluded, so disgustingly besotted. I even named her as a possible bride to my grandfather. I had the gall to propose as my queen the young woman prophesied to be his downfall, and he nearly chopped off my head in response. I'd asked her to give me hope, Hazan. I asked her to wait for me. It was she who didn't want me, who didn't want to be with me. I never trifled with her. If she'd given me even a little encouragement, I would have laid down my life for her. Happily, I would have made her my queen. Wait! No, you accuse me without evidence. I said wait, Hazan cried angrily. What on earth for? Kamran shouted back. Just shut up a moment.
Hazan swiped the book from the table, scanning the inscription on the back once again. When he looked up, he appeared confused.
Maybe, he said, his frown deepening. Maybe you are supposed to marry her.
What?
Kamran blinked. His anger vanished. His heart wrenched in his chest.
What do you mean?
Braid the thrones, it says. Hazan studied the book again, touching his fingers to the embossed letters. This is a clear message to the chosen sovereign. The last Jin kingdom existed a millennia ago, and the empire comprised only Jin. It was a purely homogeneous contingent for a number of reasons, namely in the interest of our safety. But here, he tapped the book, this message is both evident and unprecedented. She's not meant to lead the Jin in an isolated empire. She's meant to braid us all together. In this woven kingdom, clay and fire shall be.
That may well be true, Kamran said, still struggling to calm his racing pulse, to quash the hope blossoming inside him. But you're thinking of the wrong thrones. You forget that she is betrothed to the Tulanian king.
Hazan pushed a hand through his hair. I cannot accept that, he said, frustrated. You've levelled accusations against her that do not withstand reason. She would never betray her people. She would never accept assistance from Iblis, and she would never agree to marry Cyrus.
You don't actually know her, Hazan, Kamran said quietly. You only know who you want her to be.
Hazan swallowed.
Well then, he said. There's only one way to have our questions answered.
What's that?
We go to Tulan.
16.
What on earth, she said, blinking, could be worth both your life and your kingdom?
Eliza, said Cyrus quietly, and for a moment he looked quite desperate. "Please." Oh, she was not made of stone. She was not unaffected by the sound of his voice, nor the tragedy in his eyes. She understood, rationally, that Cyrus was a shameless brute, but she also knew the devil too well to dismiss the terror that accompanied his whispers, the way his riddles pierced a soul and lingered, clawing at a mind until one could think of nothing else. She couldn't help it. She pitied him. "Cyrus," she said, shaking her head, "what am I to do with your kingdom?" A flicker of irritation animated his features. "You might do the obvious thing and fulfill your destiny. You are meant to lead your people, are you not?"
"Yes," she said, subdued. "In theory."
"Well, if you take my kingdom, you might put that theory into practice," he said. "You saw our fireflies. You must realize that Tulan is home to one of the largest populations of djinn. Our numbers aren't huge, but it could be the start of something."
"But isn't that exactly what the devil wants?"
"Isn't it what you want?" he countered. "As far as I can tell, you've never bartered with Iblis, so any power you attain will be yours to do with what you will. He can only manipulate you through the will and actions of others."
"As he is now," she said wryly. "Through you."
"Right. Well," Cyrus cleared his throat. "I'm afraid the devil's wishes are a great deal more complex than this, in any case."
"And I suspect you're not allowed to tell me more?"
He laughed. The sound was bleak. "I will only say that arranging our unhappy marriage is but a fraction of what I've been commanded to do. And yet it's the scheme he cares most about. He wants me to help you attain power first and foremost, and I'd be surprised indeed if he isn't making deals with other unsuspecting fools, tethering their freedom to your ascension, much as he has with mine." "I pity them all," he said sullenly. "Dealing with you has been the simplest and by far the most punishing of all his demands."
"By far the most punishing?" Aliza echoed, almost smiling. "Come now, you don't really find me that unbearable."
"You think I exaggerate," he said tersely. "Being forced into your company ranks high on the list of the most abhorrent experiences I've ever had." The noster flared hot at that, and Aliza was thrown by the heft of the insult.
"You really mean that?" she said, astonished. "But what crimes have I committed to earn your unyielding censure?
Are you giving me permission to insult you?" She felt a flash of anger.
"I didn't realize you needed permission."
"Aliza," he said, his expression both grave and impatient, "do you have any idea how many people would leap at the opportunity to overtake my kingdom and kill me? Your hesitation is unnerving."
"But what if I don't want to kill you? What if I can't bring myself to do it?"
"What on earth would prevent you?" he shot back. "My overwhelming charm and charisma? You've been so eager to off me all this time, but now suddenly when I ask you to do the godforsaken deed, you refuse to take direction."
"Heavens, you talk almost as if you want to die."
"And you would judge me?"
He took an alarming step closer.
"For relishing an exit from this brutal consciousness we call life."
"Not really," she answered honestly, inching backward.
On more than one bleak occasion, she too had wished for a fast finish to her life, for an escape from the agonies that oppressed her. But she'd never dreamed of saying so out loud, much less to another person.
"But you're terribly morbid."
"I fear your presence inspires me." Aliza's anger sharpened. She was growing tired of his childish jabs at her pride.
"If you're so keen to die," she said, "why not let the devil do it?"
"Oh, I don't know," he said, attempting a smile. I watched you kill 5 mercenaries with an assortment of sewing supplies. I think I prefer your creativity.
Wait, what?
She blinked, alarm awakening her pulse, which fluttered fast now against her throat.
You were there?
I was there to protect the devil's darling, said Cyrus, his eyes darkening. Clearly he underestimated you.
But if you'd seen me, she said, her mind buzzing, why did you later mistake me for Miss Hooda?
At the mention of Miss Hooda, Cyrus's expression soured only further. You were always wearing your snodder, he said, and I never saw you in daylight. I stood watch that night, but only from afar. Had I been able to get closer without exposing myself, I might have been able to better hear the scandalous whispers of your next assignation. But then I saw enough of your meeting with Hazan to piece together the more unsavoury aspects of your life.
Aliza was too astonished, too outraged, even to speak.
Tell me one thing, Cyrus said bitterly. Just how many men do you have wrapped around your finger?
None, she breathed, shaking her head. Why do you continue to misjudge me? Why would you assume the worst of me, based on a single scene you witnessed without context?
You stunning little hypocrite, he said angrily. I might ask you the same question.
She looked up at him then, rendered briefly speechless, for she knew not how to respond. It was true. Most of what she knew of Cyrus, even the shocking tale of his father's murder, had been pieced together entirely by hearsay and speculation. It was just that so many people seemed to agree that he was a vile person, and the story of his rise to king was so incontrovertibly horrific that she...
Aliza hesitated, then frowned.
Wait, she said suddenly. Cyrus, you murdered your own father for your crown.
His face cleared of expression at that, his eyes going vacant and cold. That wasn't a question, he said.
You committed patricide, she went on, in the pursuit of domination and glory for control of a formidable empire. You went to such lengths for power. It couldn't have been a small thing to kill your own parent. So why would you then toss your spoils at my feet, as if your title means nothing to you?
Cyrus visibly swallowed. It was a long moment before he said, I'm quite desperate. The Noster warmed at this, but Aliza's irritation only intensified.
No, she said, shaking her head. It doesn't follow reason. There's something you haven't told me.
There are all kinds of things I haven't told you.
What kinds of things?
Oh, I don't know, he mused. I didn't say a word until I was 3 years old. I don't like eggplant, and you have a single little freckle in the hollow at the base of your throat.
Aliza clasped a hand involuntarily against her neck, almost surprised when her fingers met with the heavy gold collar of her dress, which all but obscured her throat from view. How did you know that?
I have eyes, he said flatly.
You're lying to me.
About my eyes? I assure you they're quite firmly affixed to my skull.
Cyrus,
even if I could, you think I'd tell you of all people my sorrows? He said, turning away. He sounded suddenly bored. Did you think I brought you here against your will because I was in want of a sympathetic ear?
No.
He looked up at her, a strange emotion flitting across his face. No, he echoed softly. And you should take care to remember that. Should you marry me, it would be in title only. I have no interest in your companionship. The Noster went cold.
Aliza fought both her shock and the impulse to flinch against the icy spark, her heart thrumming in her chest as she held Cyrus's gaze her alarm escalating. Was he lying about having no interest in her companionship? Or was he lying about their marriage being in title only?
"You won't," she swallowed. "That is, we won't. I mean, it's understood, isn't it, that in the off chance I agree to this arrangement, there won't be any physical aspect to the relationship?"
"No," he said sharply. "I won't touch you." The Noster warmed. Breathing a little easier, she said,
"Very good. But there's still one thing I must know. Before I can make any decision, you must tell me once and for all..."
"Ah, here we are," he said darkly. "I was wondering when you'd bring this up again. You want to know whether I've killed your melancholy king."
"Why do you continue to press this point? He's not mine."
"I have a hard time believing that."
"Truly he isn't," she said, irritated. "It was... what transpired between us was so brief, and we never... that is, he did try to make me some promises, but it was never clear, really. And I did tell him that it couldn't... that he and I..."
"Never mind," Cyrus cut her off. "I don't care to know the dizzying particulars of your relationship with the idiot heir of Ardunia."
This made her angry. "What reason could you possibly have to malign him when you're the cretin who barged into his home and killed his grandfather?"
His eyebrows went high. "Don't say you mourn the loss of the heinous King Zal."
"Oh, just answer the question, you infuriating fool."
"Which question? About whether he's dead or why I hate him?"
"I don't care if you hate him," she said. "I only want to know whether he's alive."
"And will you cry," Cyrus said quietly, "if I tell you he's not?" Aliza felt the blood drain from her face at that, horror forcing her voice to a whisper.
"Did you kill him?"
"No."
At the flash of heat from the Noster, Aliza nearly lost her footing. She closed her eyes and drew a deep, shuddering breath, involuntarily clasping a hand to her chest. Her eyes pricked with feeling, and she fought it, not recognizing until just that moment how much tension she'd been holding in her body, nor how much hope she'd held that Kamran might still be alive. Only then did she see how thoroughly she'd compartmentalized her feelings on the subject.
"I must say, I find your reaction shocking," said Cyrus, who affected a look of surprise. "It's hard to believe you truly cared for him, when you were all the while going behind his back with his home minister."
"Hazan is my friend, you terrible half-wit," she cried, and then looked sharply away, emotion threatening to disorder her.
"Was my friend. Hazan was my friend." "I warn you," said Cyrus, "if you weep, I might vomit."
Aliza managed a watery laugh, even as her heart broke, as the Noster warmed, as her vanity was wounded. The reminder of Hazan, of his sacrifice for her, made her think of her own resolution to step out of the dark, to rise up and be more for all the others who'd maintained a silent faith in her. After all, she'd been born for this. She'd been raised from infancy to lead her people, to free them from the half-lives they'd been forced to live, to fight against the injustices they'd been served for so long. She wondered then, in a moment of inspiration, what her parents would say. And when she heard a responding whisper in her heart, she felt closer to an answer. She looked up, studying Cyrus with a renewed appreciation.
"You will willingly die? Cede the throne?"
"Only," he said sharply, "after the devil releases me from my arrangement."
"And how long will that take?"
"I don't know."
Aliza took a steadying breath and considered him a moment.
Cyrus, there's something I still don't understand.
What?
He said with disdain. If you're so unafraid of death, why does it matter what the devil wants you to do? Why suffer under his command, carrying out his orders, only to be murdered regardless?
Cyrus's cold expression grew somehow icier. It was a long moment before he said, finally, I must die on my own terms.
Why?
He smiled, and there was anger in it.
If you're unable to imagine why I can't risk an untimely death, he said, then you, like all others, have built your understanding of me upon a faulty foundation.
What nonsense!
Aliza felt a flash of irritation.
Are you being intentionally cryptic?
Yes.
Oh.
Her irritation vanished.
Because of Iblis?
There's precious little I can say on this matter, he said with a swift shake of his head. So I will say only this. If I'm careful with my life now, it's because I must live long enough to accomplish something crucial. Beyond that, my beating heart is of no consequence.
He hesitated.
You have no idea what's at stake. My life is the least of it.
The Noster warmed at this admission, and Aliza felt a spike of fear.
I see, she said softly. So you mean to imply that you act now, not in your own self-interest, but for the benefit of other...
Do not speculate!
He cut her off, his voice taking on a note of panic.
Do not theorize out loud.
Okay,
she said, and swallowed.
All right.
Heavens! This confusing web grew only more tangled by the moment. Aliza could not then even wonder at what might be motivating Cyrus's actions. She didn't know enough about his life, his weaknesses, or his wants to hazard a guess.
You appear to be in quite a predicament, she said quietly. Will you not tell me what you received in exchange for your bargain with the devil?
He laughed in response, but the sound was soulless.
I will take that as a no, she said, and frowned.
Cyrus sighed.
And I take it you will not accept the terms of my offer.
She lifted her head, meeting his heated eyes.
No, she said, but I can promise you this. I will sincerely consider it.
Cyrus went briefly still. Relief hit him slowly, then suddenly, so much so that he looked as if he'd been knocked back a step. He closed his eyes as he exhaled, reaching unsteadily for the wall to support his weight.
Thank you, he whispered. Thank you.
I've not promised you anything yet, she said, approaching him with some caution. When still he didn't move, she gently prodded his chest with one finger. You shouldn't be so pleased.
Cyrus opened his eyes, and for the first time since she'd met him, he looked almost happy. It turned back time on his face, made him look more youthful. His eyes were bluer, brighter. He smiled, and it was real. She had to fight the urge to smile back.
Come with me, he said, straightening, and held out his hand.
Aliza eyed his outstretched hand warily, biting her lip as she hesitated.
Why? Are you going to throw me off a cliff again?
Maybe later, he said lightly.
Then what?
I thought you might like to see Toulon.
17.
Wait! Where are you going?
Hazan charged after the prince, who'd bolted out the door of the war room without warning and was then striding down the hall, clutching the strange book, with a speed indicative of only one of two things, eagerness or anger. Kamran wasn't sure which he felt more powerfully. That they would go to Toulon now.
that he might evade the tedious political route, circumvent the fruitless circular discussions of the nobles, who'd no doubt spend days, if not weeks, debating the merits and demerits of waging war. This was astonishing to him. He'd never considered that there might be benefits to the current nightmarish state of his life. Kamran had grown so accustomed to the shackles of royalty and the endless rigmarole that defined their international affairs that he'd not realized what freedom he might possess in the wake of all this recent personal devastation. If he were stripped of a title, if he continued to be sidelined by Zahark, if the nobles refused to include him in their discussions, well then, he might become his own master. He would go to Tulan as a man, not a prince. He would avenge his grandfather's murder on a personal mission, not an order. He would finally, after 18 years of unfailing service to the crown, do whatever he damned well pleased. Oh, he had plans for Cyrus. He would not merely kill the young man, he would first destroy him. He would make the southern king pray for death, and only then would he be merciful, fulfilling Cyrus's wishes by driving a blade through his heart. "Kamran, you ass, wait!" As was his wont, the prince did not wait. Only when Hazan had caught up to him did he answer his friend's question, but quietly, so they wouldn't be overheard. "There are an untold number of things we must do before we can leave," said Kamran. "And if we don't start now, we'll never make it in time." "In time?" Hazan stared at the prince. "In time for what?" "I don't know. I only feel that we're going to be late. Kamran, I'm going to ask you something, and I want you to know that I ask it sincerely."
"What?
Have you lost your mind?" The prince laughed at that, the sound hollow.
"I lost my mind the moment I met her, Hazan, and you were there to witness my fall from reason, so don't feign surprise now."
"I swear. Sometimes you scare me."
"Sometimes, Hazan, I scare myself."
Kamran continued moving at a steady clip, even as he glanced down at the book in his hands.
"We'll set sail tonight, at midnight, under the cover of darkness."
"Sail?" Hazan's eyes widened, nearly missing a step as he kept pace. "You mean to enter Tulan via the Mashti River? We might not survive such a journey in daylight, much less—"
"Our dragons are under heavy guard in Fesht province," Kamran said, "which you know as well as I do is a month's journey by coach. I can't summon the beasts without drawing unwanted attention, and there's no faster way to get to Tulan. Our fleet, however, have the benefit of being bolstered by magic. Water journeys often take months, not only because of the amount of work required at every stage, but also because of the immense cargo we haul. Without the added weight of metric tons of water, we'll move much faster, and by the time anyone notices our absence in the morning, we'll be gone. I've done enough water journeys to know the way well enough, and I can sail any ship myself. So long as we avoid major delays or turbulent weather, we might be able to clear the distance in under a week."
Hazan fell silent at that, even as his eyes were troubled.
"Very well," he said finally. "What will you tell the boy?" "Omid," Kamran frowned. "Nothing. The fewer people who know of our whereabouts, the better."
"And why must we keep our journey a secret?"
"Because I'd rather they didn't know where to find me."
"Who?" Hazan said, brows furrowing.
"I didn't realize you were being hunted." "No, but I soon will be."
Kamran rounded the corner and rushed up the grand marble staircase, the staccato knock of his boots echoing in the massive hall.
"I intend to empty out the treasure houses before we go, and I'd rather not leave an easily followed trail, else the nobles will sort out my execution with impressive speed."
"Wait," Hazan hurried up the stairs alongside him. "What need do you have of the treasure houses?"
gold, weapons, horses. Kamran came to an abrupt stop at the landing and turned sharply to face Hazan. This task I leave to you. Open our stores while we still have access, and take a great deal more than you think we'll require. If I'm to be ousted from the palace, I'll need a place to land upon our return. Find us somewhere safe. Purchase property from an unsuspecting farmer if you must. Then organize a team of the finest riders and fighters and compensate them handsomely for a period of 6 months. We will require our own armed force. Tell me you jest. You are more than capable.
Hazan stared at him in stupefaction. You want me to raid the coffers of the crown, travel north to the country, chase down a farmer, buy his broken home, scour the empire for its best mercenaries, and form a covert militia, all in the same day?
You are possessed of supernatural speed, strength, and invisibility, Hazan. I grant you full permission to use your powers for good.
And if I'm stopped by a magistrate?
Kamran reached into his pocket, retrieved a coin, and flipped it in the air, watching as Hazan easily caught the piece in one hand.
Show them this, said the prince. It has my seal upon it, which they will believe is forged.
I feel confident you will figure it out, Kamran said with some finality.
Hazan shot him a dark look, but still he gave Kamran a deferential nod.
You are very lucky, then, that I already have a trusted team upon whom I rely. They'll make a fine militia.
Kamran, who'd been about to resume his walk, turned fully to face his friend. He was unable to leech the surprise from his voice when he said,
You have a team?
I've never worked alone, said Hazan quietly. I'm not the only one who's been searching for her, you know.
The prince looked away at that, subdued. For over a year, he'd been reading about small revolts in djinn communities throughout Ardunia. He'd thought they were merely unhappy, seeking change. He'd not known then that they might have sought solace in the idea of a lost empire, that some might have even been searching for an unknown leader around whom they might rally.
No, he said finally. I suspect you're not.
Kamran, the prince looked up, the question in his eyes.
What will you do? Hazan asked, watching him closely.
When you see her?
At the mere suggestion, Kamran's heart reacted.
Until this very moment he'd managed to avoid visualizing this part. Some protective instinct in his brain had prevented him from focusing too much on the aspect of the journey that might injure him most.
But that he might see her again, speak with her again so soon, it was almost too much.
He felt the grip of a terrible anxiety close around his throat, experiencing an inexplicable pain in the aftermath, a searing heat along his breastbone he could not fathom into words. She'd betrayed him, punched through his sternum with the heft of it, and he didn't know what he'd do when he saw her again, for he couldn't know what he'd uncover in Tulan. Either he'd discover he'd been a faithless jackass to have doubted her, or he'd be dealt a final obliterating blow he feared would break him. He might fall to his knees before her, or he might be forced to kill her. The possibility left him sick. His voice was an unrecognizable rasp when he said, finally answering Hazan's question,
I don't know.
For what it's worth, sire, I don't believe she betrayed any of us.
Enough, Kamran said, turning away. We've much to do. You will meet me at the docks at midnight.
Hazan stared at him a beat. Then, with a nod, his former minister was gone, and in his wake, Kamran found he could not move. He stared into the middle distance, clutching the book in his hand ever more tightly. Her handkerchief he'd tucked into his pocket
much earlier, telling himself he'd deliver it to her himself one day, not knowing then how soon he might face her. Kamran had never known how muddy grief might be. It had never occurred to him that the death of a loved one might prove difficult to mourn, or that a heart might continue to beat long after it was broken. He'd not been taught to navigate this misty middle track of uncertainty. No, Kamran had lived always with the luxury of absolutes. Even in childhood he'd known the delineated position he was meant to occupy in the world, had known the rules that corralled his life. He'd stepped from one gilded milestone to another with a confidence so complete it had never occurred to him, not until Aliza tore open his life, to doubt the course laid before him. Now he stood at the mouth of an indistinct, untravelled path, his role, his title, his tomorrow, all unknown.
"Hey, Jan! Hey, Jan! Sire! Sire!"
Very slowly, Kamran turned toward the desperate sound, catching sight of the long-legged child struggling up the stairs, two at a time. Kamran had been on his way back to his rooms to manage a bit of correspondence. He meant to send a letter to his aunt Jamila, whose conspicuous silence in the aftermath of Zal's death had struck him as deeply unusual, and ask if she'd welcome a visit from him on the morrow. He did not intend, of course, to actually pay the dear woman a visit. He was only hoping to leave a paper trail that might convolute the details of his disappearance. It seemed this would have to wait. When Omid finally reached the landing, he doubled over almost at once, bracing his hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath.
"I've been looking for you," he panted. "Everywhere."
"Yes. And what took you so long?" Kamran said quietly. "Are they here yet?"
Omid tried to stand up and nearly made it, squinting one eye as he breathed, reinforcing the effort to be vertical with one hand placed firmly on his hip.
"They won't come, sire," he said, gasping in Feshtun. "They don't believe me when I say they've been summoned by the crown."
Kamran closed his eyes and sighed. This morning, grieving, delirious, and, admittedly, not quite in possession of his faculties, Kamran had thought he'd no one else to trust. In the wake of one heroic act, the boy had seemed an obvious choice for a role meant to prioritize the prince's safety and protection above all else. Now Kamran was beginning to wonder whether Hazan had been right. This had perhaps been a terrible idea.
"We should have gotten you a new wardrobe," Kamran said, opening his eyes to study the boy's oversized, ill-fitting clothes anew. "Of course they don't believe you. You don't look as if you come from a royal household." He looked askance at the child. "Why did you not take the carriage as I instructed? The royal seal would have been proof enough for anyone."
Omid shook his head, hard.
"I tried, sire. Honest, I did. But he wouldn't let me take the carriage."
Now Kamran frowned.
"Who wouldn't let you take the carriage?"
"The coachman. He told me he'd whip me if I so much as touched one of the coaches. So I've been running round on foot, you see, which is why it took me so long."
"Dear God."
The boy flushed a bright red.
"I am terribly sorry. And these..."
He stared down at himself, tugging at the hem of his too long tunic.
"Well, these are all the clothes I've got, sire, and I don't know what to do about them. But I'd hate to toss them because they were gifts from..."
His eyes filled with tears.
"Well, from the diviners, see, and they were ever so kind to me."
Kamran held up a hand to stop the boy from blubbering. He himself had not shed a single tear since the night prior, and while there was an aspect of his consciousness
that suspected, on some base level, that this was probably strange. There was a much larger, louder, and unhealthier part of him that took pride in his ability to keep his emotions constrained. "This is my fault," Kamran said to the child. "I should have seen to your clothes before sending you off on an errand. And it didn't occur to me that I might have to make introductions to the staff. You are not to blame on these counts." He sighed. "In fact, I see now that I made a larger mistake in giving you so much responsibility. You're clearly a poor fit for this role."
"No, sire!"
The boy threw out a hand as if to stop Kamran from speaking, realized too late that he'd nearly touched the prince, and recoiled in horror.
"I'm sorry, I mean, forgive me, Omid, please,"
the boy said, wiping desperately now at his damp face and straightening to his full height.
"I can do it, sire. I promise I can. I want this job more than anything. My ma and pa would be so proud if they could see how I'd turned things around. And I promise I'll show you what I can do. On my parents' graves, sire, I swear it."
Kamran narrowed his eyes at the boy, who was standing now at attention, his red-rimmed eyes no longer leaking. In any other situation, Kamran would have dismissed the child without question. But the stakes were admittedly low at this juncture. Come tomorrow morning, Kamran would be gone. Too, he was anticipating trouble from the nobles, taking for granted that the distorted magic snaking along his body would all but guarantee his expulsion. He felt uncertain only about when he'd be asked to leave, for he'd so far managed to evade what seemed an inevitable encounter with Zahak himself. As if he'd conjured the man with his mind, Kamran saw out of the corner of his eye the slinky retreat of the defence minister, who'd appeared down the hall as if out of the ether. He was moving with some haste in the direction of the king's wing of the palace, though what Zahak hoped to do in his grandfather's rooms was a mystery, one Kamran was eager to unravel. If the defence minister's darting eyes were any indication, the answers were bound to be bleak.
"Sire?"
Kamran returned his gaze to the boy, his mind working double time, assessing the situation from all possible angles in the space of a millisecond. As Zahak's treacherous figure grew fainter in the distance, Kamran grew certain he'd know more about his fate in the palace very, very soon. In which case there was little point, he reasoned, in breaking the boy's heart. He might as well let the child dream a day more.
"Very well," Kamran said stiffly, lowering his voice. "But if they're not here by nightfall, I'm placing you elsewhere in the palace. I'm sure we could use a new stable boy."
He paused, assessing the child.
"Are you any good with horses?"
Omid was shaking his head so hard, Kamran feared he might shift things around in there permanently.
"I don't like horses, sir, and they don't like me. I'll get it done. You won't need to place me elsewhere. They'll be here by nightfall, I swear it."
And as Omid darted away, dashing down the staircase at a dangerous clip, Kamran changed course too, following Zahak's trail toward his grandfather's rooms. 18.
"I beg your pardon," Aliza blinked at Cyrus. "You want to show me Tulan?"
"Aren't you curious?"
"Very," she said. "It's only that I didn't think you'd let me leave the palace."
Cyrus laughed at that, then frowned.
"Why wouldn't I let you leave the palace?"
She matched his look of confusion.
"Because," she said slowly, "I would run away, you see. And you need me to remain here and do your bidding, or else the devil is going to kill you."
"Ah," he grimaced. "Right. Well, in that case, I must get on. I suppose I'll see you at dinner,
should you choose to join me?"
He gave her a nod, turned on his heel, and with a purposeful stride, headed to the door. Aliza watched this happen with undisguised disappointment.
"Wait," she called out, crestfallen. "Are you really leaving? Are we really not going to see Toulon?"
Cyrus hesitated, but didn't turn to face her. She saw only the tense back of him, his copper hair a brilliant contrast to his simple black coat. She was again struck by the cut of him, the space he commanded even now when she couldn't see his face. He said softly, "It was rather foolish of you to mention the bit about running away."
"I know," Aliza bit her lip. "I'm quite sorry for it now."
Slowly he turned around.
"Are you saying you're not going to run away then?"
Aliza prevaricated. She was torn, but also distracted. The sun had changed positions in the last hour, and shafts of golden luminescence were flooding the room through the glass doors and open windows, anointing all in their path. Even Cyrus was caught in this tempest of light, the hard lines of his body limned around the edges, a diffuse glow dancing across his face, painting his eyes. He squinted against the brightness, his pupils contracting to pinpoints, blowing out the blue of his irises. She watched him watch her a moment, his confusion apparent. Aliza didn't mind. She let her gaze wander as she mulled over her warring emotions. She felt less inclined to flee this castle than she had upon arrival, not only because she'd been made two rather robust offers in that time, but also because, well, the truth was, she had nowhere else to go. Here, at least, her favour was being courted by both mother and child, and Aliza, who'd been forced to sleep too many brutal nights in the gutter, her cheek pressed to the filth of a city street, did not take for granted the luxury of a warm bed. She could not deny that this was a lovely place to rest a while and to sort through the myriad disasters strewn before her. In fact, she could still hear the birds chirping outside, the hush of the waterfalls in the distance, the efforts of the wind pushing apart branches, rattling leaves. It was, in a word, lovely. And she did dearly wish to see Toulon. Unfamiliar as she was with the manipulation of magic, Aliza was aware enough to understand that there was some kind of enchantment in the air here, for the season was entirely wrong. True, Toulon was farther south than Ardunia, which was in the midst of a ruthless winter, but the two empires shared a border. Some variation in temperature would not have been amiss, but this was practically summer. Aliza would be lying if she said she didn't prefer it. She lifted her eyes, finally meeting Cyrus's impatient gaze. Hesitantly, she said, "Perhaps I won't run away today." His agitation gave way to visible bemusement.
"Is that so? Having a good time then, are you? Enjoying my hospitality?"
Quietly, Aliza cleared her throat.
"You may choose to poke fun," she said, clasping and unclasping her hands. "But I am deciding, after all, whether or not to marry you, and I think I should be allowed to see the land you intend to leave me before I make my choice."
Cyrus stiffened at that. He stared at her, unblinking, the light dying in his eyes as he turned slowly away, lapsing into silence. In fact, he said nothing for so long that Aliza felt forced, in the mounting discomfort of the moment, to speak.
"Cyrus?" she said uneasily. "Are you all right?"
He looked up.
"Ever?"
she frowned.
"You know," he said, attempting a laugh, "I realize you might not believe this, but I never dreamed I'd one day be forced to take a wife in this manner.
He shook his head, turned away again. I'm trying to give you Tulan, a jewel among empires, a land that is my home. I stand here begging you to marry me, to kill me, and take my nation, my crown, my legacy, and you won't even say yes. He closed his eyes and swore. I really thought I'd already hit rock bottom, but this is a shade of wretchedness I've never known. The Nosta warmed at this sad speech, and Aliza's pliable heart felt a rush of pity, which she hated. She hated that she could not unceremoniously loathe him, hated that she could not shift the levers that ruled her emotions, hated that she was unable to power off compassion when the feeling was inappropriate. With a sigh, Aliza approached him. Cyrus's head shot up at her advance like he was being hunted, and he watched her with increasing wariness until she met him where he stood, halfway across the room. She then surprised herself by doing something that was either stupid or bold. She couldn't decide. She touched his arm. Or at least, she tried. Cyrus caught her hand before she even made contact, his reflexes so fast she hardly realized what had happened, until she saw with some astonishment that he held her limb upright before her eyes. His hand enveloped hers in both size and warmth as he studied her, his own eyes wild and wondering. Aliza felt she couldn't move. She was still a stone, marvelling that she could perceive slight calluses against his skin when his fingers slid, in a stuttering pattern, down the undersides of her knuckles, inspiring a slow burn of sensation so unexpected she nearly gasped. Awareness quickened through her. He drew his hand slowly downward, grazing her palm until he'd clasped her wrist like a bracelet, his fingers pressing tenderly against her racing pulse. She wondered if he was counting the beats there, cataloguing her reaction.
Aliza, he said, his voice low, heavy. He was looking at her like she might have been about to stab him through the heart. What are you doing?
I wasn't. She shook her head, found her voice. I swear I wasn't going to hurt you.
Cyrus dropped her hand like it had burned him, stepping farther away from her. He was breathing just a touch too fast, his eyes heavily guarded. Then what were you going to do?
She hesitated, deliberating over whether to admit the truth, and then feeling too stupid to do so. Again she shook her head. Nothing, I swear.
Aliza! He sounded angry now. Why did you try to touch me? What is your game?
I was just... She sighed. Oh, this is ridiculous, she said in a frustrated burst. I was only trying to be sympathetic.
He blinked at her, even as tension visibly fled his body. You were trying to be sympathetic? He echoed, his incomprehension palpable. You mean, you were trying to console me?
Yes.
He pointed at himself. Me?
You know what? An angry blush burned across her cheeks. Never mind.
Cyrus stared at her for a full second before he finally broke and laughed out loud. I tell you a single sad story and your defences weaken that easily? Against me? You lovely little fool, you're going to get yourself killed.
Oh, shut up!
She crossed her arms. He shook his head slowly, closing the distance between them again, his eyes analysing her carefully, lingering along the lines of her face. For a moment he almost looked as if he might touch her, though he never did. Humour me, he whispered. What were you going to say? How did you intend to comfort me?
I wasn't going to say anything.
Were you going to tell me not to worry, he said, still smiling. Were you going to remind me that, though my life is essentially worthless, I should keep my chin up and look on the bright side?
No, she said, hearing the breathless sound of her voice and hating it. I had no intention of feeding you such nonsense. I don't see any bright side to this.
He took a deep breath, his chest lifting with the effort. It was a long moment before he said, You know, neither did I. Aliza's heart was pounding too hard. She didn't know how the two of them kept finding themselves in these charged moments, and as a result she didn't know how to escape them. There was something decidedly fascinating about Cyrus, something potent and complex, and prodding him for truth felt a lot like prodding a sore muscle. The results were both painful and pleasant. She pitied him even as she detested him, understood him even as she scorned him. He was a series of mystery boxes she wasn't certain she wanted to open, and whose hidden depths tempted her, even as they scared her. She didn't know what she wanted from him, or whether she wanted anything at all, and then he touched her. He lowered his eyes and touched her, breaking the trance between them so abruptly, Aliza drew a sharp, unsteady breath. She watched him smile at the sound she'd made, laughing quietly to himself as he dragged his fingers lightly down the front of her gown from just under her breasts to the apex of her navel. She tore away, but too late.
What are you doing?
She said, trying to call upon anger and struggling. Her head grew cloudy when he stood near, and she made a silent note to herself to keep distance between their bodies.
I was fixing your dress, he said, taking a step back. I didn't think you'd want to keep the stain.
Aliza looked at herself as if emerging from a dream, absently patting down the bodice of her frock. The brown spatter of tea that had so thoroughly soiled the gossamer layers was now gone. Her dress was restored entirely.
How did you do that?
She whispered, staring up at him with wide eyes.
How do you cast spells so easily?
Aren't you meant to wield great power? He asked, brows furrowing in confusion. How is it you're so unschooled in the workings of magic?
She flushed lightly under his questioning, feeling self-conscious.
My magic, should I ever possess it, is meant to come to me without formal education. It's meant to be intuitive.
Fascinating, he said, his frown only deepening. And you know nothing else? You don't know what it is?
No,
she said, suddenly uncomfortable. She couldn't tell whether his was an honest, casual question, or whether he was deftly mining her for information. Either way, she proceeded with caution.
As far as I'm aware, no one does.
Why not?
Because in all of recorded history it's never before been accessed, she said briskly, then changed the subject. As to more ordinary enchantments, I know only rudimentary things. Ardunio is too large an empire to rely upon magic to thrive. For us, it is a very limited resource, and thus it's used only sparingly. It's also owned and regulated entirely by the Crown. We're not allowed to use it as we wish.
Yes, he said quietly. I've heard that Ardunians teach magic only to those interested in joining the priesthood. She nodded.
The same isn't true in Tulan, though, is it? Your mother told me you've been studying divination and sorcery since you were a child, and it takes but one working eye to deduce there's nothing even remotely priest-like about you.
He froze, briefly surprised by the insult, and then laughed with his whole body, his shoulders shaking, his eyes crinkling at the edges. "Heavens," he said, "tell me how you really feel."
"Take care, Cyrus," she chided him. "If you keep laughing like that, I'm liable to think you have a heart."
"Oh, you needn't worry," he said, his smile fading. "I most certainly don't."
The Noster went cold. Aliza's own smile faltered at that, some essential armour crumbling inside her. She suddenly didn't know what to say.
"Come along then," he said, quite literally moving past the moment as he strode to the door. "If you're really so uninformed, I'll show you how it works."
"How what works?" She stared at him, unmoving. "And where do you mean to take me? Are we going into Tulan now?"
Aliza saw only the back of his head when he said, "Yes."
"Really?" She hurried after him. "And you're no longer worried I'll run away?"
"No."
"Wait. Why not?"
Aliza stopped in place.
"You should be a little worried, at the very least."
"I'm afraid that's not possible," he said, finally turning around to face her. "For I've recently deduced that you're quite charmingly pathetic."
Aliza stiffened, shock and outrage awakening in her body. "How dare you," she said, drawing herself up to her full height, her fists clenching. "I am not pathetic."
"I have a theory," he said, cutting her off as he walked backward to the door, "that if I were badly wounded, you would help me. True or false?"
"False."
His smile widened.
"Liar."
"I wouldn't," she said ruthlessly.
"I'd leave you there and run for my life."
He was fighting a massive grin now, his eyes glittering with barely suppressed delight.
"You would save me." "I'd absolutely let you die." He shook his head.
"You wouldn't be able to leave me behind."
"I would too," she insisted.
"You certainly should," he said softly. "For it'd be terribly stupid to save me, and I didn't think you were stupid."
She couldn't believe she'd ever felt sorry for him. She wanted to pummel him now. "I'm not stupid," she said angrily.
"I never said you were stupid." Cyrus was at the door, gripping the handle. "I'm merely pointing out that all signs seem to indicate you might be."
"Oh, you're truly awful," she said, glaring at him even as she stalked to the door. "You're mean and awful, and I regret ever feeling bad for you."
He raised his eyebrows. "Your first mistake was ever feeling bad for me."
"It's a mistake I won't make again."
He stared in silent amusement as she pushed him aside, turned the knob, took a single step over the threshold, and screamed. There was no ground beyond the door. Aliza pinwheeled backward, teetering violently until Cyrus caught her, steadying her flailing body against his chest. She'd plummeted from the sky too many times in the last 24 hours to stomach another such fall so soon. Her poor nerves were frayed.
"Why is there nothing out there?" she practically cried. "Why is this castle so strange?"
"Aliza,
is this actually a prison?"
Her panic was escalating now.
"Have you locked me in a tower? Am I never meant to leave?"
"Aliza!"
"No!"
She pushed at him until he let go of her, until he stumbled a few steps away from her.
"I don't like you, and I don't trust you, and I wouldn't save you, you despicable, good-for-nothing, unprincipled reprobate!"
He grabbed hold of her shoulders anyway, tried to look her in the eye.
"Aliza, you infuriating girl, listen to me." "I certainly will not listen to you. And how dare you call me stupid and infuriating?"
"The stairs are made of glass." Aliza went suddenly still. She reanimated by degrees, mustering what was left of her dignity as she adjusted her dress and stepped gingerly away from him, after which she peered through the open door and over the threshold, this time looking more closely.
Well, she said, taking a sharp breath. I suppose they are made of glass.
She crossed her arms, unable to look at him.
But that's a foolish idea, you know, having stairs made of glass. It's quite dangerous.
Cyrus was silent for so long, she eventually dared to look up at him, and found him staring at her with the oddest expression on his face. He appeared both pained and confused. She couldn't quite define it, and she didn't know what it meant. Feeling sheepish, she lowered her eyes again, wondering whether he'd changed his mind about showing her magic and seeing Tulan.
Aliza, he said finally.
She did not look up, choosing to stare instead at her feet, which she'd earlier tucked into a very pretty pair of boots.
I do realize I just called you a fair amount of terrible names, but I'd still very much like to see Tulan.
Why are you refusing to look at me?
Why should I? She said quietly. I've already seen your face.
Aliza,
you know you say my name a lot.
I say your name, he said tersely. A perfectly normal amount.
Do you really think so?
She peeked up at him, and he looked mad about it.
Yes.
Well, I suppose that might be true, she said. It's been so long since anyone has spoken to me in earnest that I fear I've lost perspective.
He hesitated.
What do you mean?
She shook her head, wincing as grief caught her, the way it always did, at the most inopportune moments. It had been years and years since her parents died, and for so long since then, she'd only ever been commanded, never acknowledged. Mrs. Amina had never even asked her name.
Nothing, she said brightly,
even as she sniffed suddenly against a swell of feeling.
What are you... Oh, for heaven's sake, are you going to cry again? I'll take you to see the blasted city, Aliza. I'll show you the bloody magic. You don't have to cry about everything.
I'm not crying, she said irritably. I'm thinking. Sometimes I get emotional when I'm thinking.
When you're thinking? You mean all the time, then?
He pushed his hands through his hair and swore under his breath.
The devil really is trying to kill me.
She wiped at her eyes.
I thought you already knew that.
All right, that's quite enough out of you, he said.
And then he took her hand without warning and tugged her out the door. 19. Aliza stared wonderingly at the piece of bread she was holding, turning it over in her hands. Cyrus had earlier ripped in half a larger round, and the share she held was, as a result, an unconventional shape, something like a crescent moon. It was still warm, too. They'd been walking past a bakery when Aliza had smelled the familiar scent, and after she'd commented aloud that in her life she'd only ever walked past bakeries, never stepping inside of one, Cyrus had expressed surprise. He'd asked her why she'd never been inside of a bakery, for surely Ardunia was not so pathetic an empire as to lack such establishments, to which she'd responded that Ardunia was quite thick with bakeries, thank you very much. It was only that she'd never had the time to visit one, for she'd always worked at minimum 12-hour shifts, though even if she'd had the time, she'd reasoned, she'd invariably lacked the money to purchase anything from such a place, and as a result hadn't seen the point in torturing herself with even the possibility of such decadence. Cyrus had abruptly taken her by the arm then, given her a strange look, and guided her toward the shop in question, into which they disappeared for a wondrous few moments and emerged shortly thereafter with bread. Bread that Cyrus had purchased for her. She'd not thought they'd actually buy anything, not only because Eliza had no money, but because in all her life, no one but her parents had ever bought her anything. The entire experience of being out with Cyrus, from the moment they'd said goodbye to a smug Sarah, who'd seen their clasped hands and given Eliza a sly, encouraging nod, to the current moment they occupied now, had been so unfamiliar and strange that Eliza hardly knew what to do with herself. If she tried to think about it all in full, she thought her head might fall off. For now, she focused on the bread. With a bit of guidance from her unlikely and surprisingly patient companion, Eliza had chosen a small, humble disc of the baked good. It was fairly thin, visibly hand-kneaded, and had been sprinkled generously with sesame seeds. It was brown and crispy on the outside, but, she poked its insides now with one finger, light and springy within. This accomplishment struck her as functionally impossible.
"Did they make this with magic?" she asked Cyrus, still poking the soft interior.
There were many little holes inside, and she couldn't imagine how someone might have scooped out bits of dough from the middle without disturbing the perfect, crunchy shell. Cyrus, who was actually eating his piece of bread, was still chewing when he looked over at her, staring at her now like she might be touched in the head. He swallowed.
"Please tell me you're joking."
"Well, if you're going to be rude about it," she said, "I'll just keep my questions to myself."
"Eliza,"
she pretended not to hear him. Instead, she picked cautiously at the crust, attempting to break the shell away to fully expose the soft, spongy inside. She crunched on a piece of the crust first, her voracious senses savouring the mild taste and crisp texture, and then bit into the pillowy middle, which was, she raised her eyebrows, surprisingly chewy. Eliza decided she liked bread very much. They were wandering down a bright, delightful avenue finished with gleaming ivory pavers, the street hemmed in on either side by colourful shops of all kinds. Eliza had already looked around a great deal, but just then she was looking up as they strolled, mesmerised by the majesty of the stratospheric ceiling above them, and which was not a ceiling at all, but an unfathomable number of wisteria vines stretched across the width of the road, crisscrossing from the top of one building to another. The purple flowers, Cyrus had explained, had been bewitched to bloom in perpetuity. They hung in astonishing masses from on high, like ripe, decadent grapes, their otherworldly honeyed scent infusing the air around them, while loose fallen petals decorated all in a surreal confetti. Occasionally a strong gust of wind blew through and shook the vines, resulting in a soft shower of wisteria petals, the sight and smell of which were so heavenly, so overwhelmingly beautiful, that Eliza thought she might lie down in the middle of the road and happily die of delight.
"Eliza," Cyrus said again.
"Hmm?"
She was still staring at the flowers, picking apart her bread methodically.
"What are you doing?" he said, audibly frustrated. "The crust is not a skin. You don't have to peel it off to eat the insides."
"I wasn't peeling it," she scoffed, finally turning to look at him. "I was studying it. I was wondering, though, could you tell me how the baker's poked all these little holes in the middle without breaking the shell? It seems terribly clever."
Cyrus came to a sudden stop.
"My word," he breathed. "Have you never eaten bread before?"
She frowned.
"Of course I have."
"You haven't, have you? You've never eaten bread before."
"Not true," she said, pointing a finger. "Once,
In one of my previous positions working in a big house, I was clearing away the dishes in the breakfast room, and there was still so much food untouched. An entire tray of perfectly good toast, can you imagine? And I was so curious, I actually took a small bite.
Cyrus only stared at her.
When was this?
A couple of years ago. He searched the skies then as if for strength, and turned back to her with a sigh.
Once, a couple of years ago, you had a single bite of toast? That's it?
Well, I couldn't bring myself to do it again, she said, worrying her lip. One of the other servants saw me do the shameful deed and snitched straight away to the housekeeper, who promptly dismissed me from my position. I tried to point out that I'd not been stealing, as she'd so unfairly described it, for we'd been ordered to toss all the bread straight into the trash, which seemed to me a shocking waste.
Heavens, Eliza.
Cyrus had gone completely slack.
You might be the strangest girl I've ever met in all my life.
Are you insulting me?
Without question.
She shot him a dirty look, but Cyrus only laughed. Just then came a series of shouts. A team of men were unrolling a massive rug from a high balcony, the intricate piece unfurling in the sun like a newborn leaf. Suspended only by their efforts, it hung in the wind like a magnificent flag, its silk threads shimmering as one of them shouted rather aggressively from the balustrade about good prices and discounted delivery. Despite her irritation, Eliza smiled. There were aspects of Tulan's royal city, Mesti, Cyrus had called it, that reminded her very much of Setar, but there were rather glaring differences between them too. First, they spoke a duo of languages in equal measure here. Tulan was positioned just beyond Fesht province, the southernmost territory of Ardunia, and as a result, there'd been quite a bit of blending along borders. The Tulanian people spoke Feshtun and Ardans, though Eliza occasionally thought she heard people speaking a third, unofficial dialect that sounded like a slapdash mix of both. Second, and most obvious, while both royal cities were stunning feats of colour and architecture, only one had been built with an abundance of magic. Tulan being but a fraction the size of Ardunia, its royal city was a great deal smaller, giving it a cosier quality, where every inch felt cleaner, more closely cared for, and delicately enchanted. Eliza had been taking it all in with the enthusiasm of an ingenue, absorbing the life and bustle of the atmosphere, not unlike a child discovering wind for the first time.
"What other essential things must I know about you?" Cyrus was saying. "Have you never had a glass of milk, for example? Have you never eaten a piece of cake? Do you need me to teach you how to use a knife and fork?"
Eliza felt her face heat at that last question, for she'd almost certainly require such lessons. She'd only ever fumbled poorly with utensils, because she'd never had any use for them. As a servant, she'd tried on many occasions to familiarise herself with their many uses, but whenever she lingered too long watching people eat, she was either punished or sacked. "You," she said finally, turning away to hide her embarrassment, "are being intentionally mean. You know full well that I'm not like you, that I don't need to eat food to survive."
"Oh, don't you dare blame your strangeness on your own people," he said, cutting her off. They'd started walking again. "There are many thousands of djinn in Tulan who don't need to eat, and yet they patronize the local grocers and bakeries with gusto."
At the mention of djinn, Eliza faltered a moment. She'd be surprised indeed if Cyrus hadn't noticed the many strange looks she'd been getting.
He was too discerning to miss such a thing, but he hadn't said a word about it, which led her to worry she might be imagining things. Still, she struggled to deny outright what seemed increasingly obvious. Jin here seemed preternaturally attuned to her. Their heads lifted as she passed, looks of confusion crossing their faces. They frowned at her, as if they were supposed to know her, as if her face belonged to an acquaintance whose name they struggled to recall. More than once, someone did a double take as she went by, only to turn and whisper urgently to their companion, saying something she couldn't hear. It was the fireflies that gave them away. Were it not for the cheerful insects bobbing alongside their owners, Aliza might not have been able to discern the difference between clay and djinn residents, who swarmed about town with an ordinariness unseen even in Ardunia. Back home, djinn were legally free to go about their days as they wished, but they lived always with a caution that defined all aspects of their existence. They kept their heads down, spoke little, didn't mix much with clay, and retreated to their own circles whenever possible. For reasons unknown, djinn seemed happier here. Nevertheless, Aliza felt the rise of a familiar apprehension in her chest, something she'd felt many times in her life, and that suggested she was being followed. She and Cyrus had only resumed walking for a minute now, and already she was noticing more and more eyes in her direction. She glanced around nervously, likely giving herself away in the process, but it couldn't be helped. Someone was there. "Cyrus," she said quietly.
"No, I don't want to argue about it," he said, gesticulating with his unfinished bread. "It's my business to know the consumption habits of my own citizens, and I swear to you, djinn eat all the time."
"Cyrus," she hissed, tugging on his arm.
"What?"
He turned to look at her, and in an instant his frustration gave way to concern. This reaction was in and of itself something to wonder about, though perhaps some other time.
"What is it?" he said, stopping abruptly. "What's wrong?"
She ducked her head and whispered, "Is it too late to put an illusion on me?" Cyrus's concern morphed into alarm. Immediately he looked up and down the street, then searched higher, scanning the sky. She realized he was looking for assailants.
"I don't think anyone is trying to kill me," she said lightly, trying for a bit of levity. "But I do think someone is following us."
He swore under his breath. Earlier, Cyrus had used magic to render an illusion around himself. As a result, people who saw him registered only a forgettable face, one they instantly put out of their minds. He'd explained that it was the only way he could walk freely about Tulan, for he'd once caused a riot, even heavily obscured in a mask and hooded cloak.
"It's my bloody hair," he'd muttered with no small amount of bitterness. "This colour is a curse."
He'd insisted upon drawing an illusion about her face as well, but Aliza had adamantly refused. She didn't trust Cyrus enough to allow him to use magic on her, and for obvious reasons. The last time she'd trusted one of his enchantments to protect her, she'd been unceremoniously dragged up into the air, dropped onto the back of a dragon, and delivered directly into the devil's trap.
"No magic," she'd maintained.
While all of Ardunia's nobles had seen something of her face, and her undergarments, apparently, she'd since fled and entered a completely different empire. It had seemed unlikely that anyone in Tulan would know who she was. Cyrus had relented begrudgingly, though only because she'd agreed to wear a rather large hat, which she'd pulled low over her eyes. A useless hat, apparently.
"If someone is already watching," Cyrus said,
still furtively scanning the street. They'll see the illusion take effect, which means they might yet be able to track you. First, we need to go somewhere relatively deserted. Did you see where this person went?
Aliza shook her head, and then, as surreptitiously as was physically possible, glanced over her shoulder. There was a young woman there. She was wearing a bright red dress, standing stock still in the middle of the avenue, staring at Aliza with wide, unblinking eyes.
"She's just there," Aliza whispered. "Right behind us."
Cyrus echoed her earlier movement, glancing cautiously over his shoulder, but then he turned all the way around, making no secret of his search. He frowned. "What lady?" he said, not bothering to lower his voice. "There's no one here."
"You don't see her?"
"I don't see anyone," he said. "Maybe it only seemed like she was following us." Feeling a sense of relief, Aliza sighed.
"Yes," she said, pivoting to survey the street. "Maybe she..."
Aliza had lifted the brim of her hat as she turned, hoping for a better look, when the young woman fell without warning to her knees. She pointed a shaking finger at Aliza and screamed. She screamed, crying out so violently, Aliza was excoriated by the sound, by the weight of it, the wildness. She couldn't move, even as she trembled, as her face paled. She felt bolted to the ground.
"Aliza," said Cyrus urgently. "What's wrong? What's happening?"
"You can't hear that," she managed to whisper,
her heart pounding furiously in her chest.
"Can you?"
"Hear what?"
The woman in the street was still screaming, sobbing hysterically and shrieking.
"Aliza?"
"Cyrus!"
She was breathing hard and reached for his arm without looking, clenching a fistful of his shirt sleeve.
"Why didn't you tell me that Jinn in Tulan were allowed to use their strengths openly?"
"You..."
He looked down, confused, at her death grip.
"You never asked. And we've had a number of other things to..."
Cyrus inhaled sharply. His eyes went wide as, Aliza could only imagine, the screaming girl came suddenly into view. The young woman had likely lost control of her invisibility in the furor, and her screams echoed through the avenue now, as people of all kinds came running from every direction. They tried to help the girl up, but she wouldn't be moved. She shook off their assistance, alternately pointing at Aliza and dragging her hands down her face. Aliza could feel Cyrus panic.
"Let's go," he said. "Right now."
"No, I can't. I can't just leave her."
A crowd was gathering now, eyes following the direction of the young woman's outstretched finger, and as the shouts and whispers reached a stunning crescendo, the screaming woman broke somehow further, a tortured expression overtaking her face, a mix of something like joy and grief, tears still streaking down her cheeks. She finally managed intelligible speech.
"It's true," she cried. "They said you were here. I didn't believe, but it's true."
"Who?" someone else called out. "Who is she?"
"The servant boy from the palace," a man shouted. "He said..."
"No, it can't be."
"Aliza," Cyrus said urgently. "I know you asked me not to use magic on you, but please, let me get you out of here."
"In the Ardunian newspaper from last night."
"No, long before that. We've been hearing whispers for days."
"I can't leave," Aliza said desperately, her pulse skyrocketing. "Can I? These people, they're my responsibility."
Cyrus tugged her sharply back as the crowd surged forward, and her hat fell to the ground with a dull thud. There was no time to retrieve it. The mass wasted no time swarming her as one, trying to get a better look.
"Her eyes!"
And her hair, she wears a crown. It's just as they said. My wife's cousin in Sitar sent her a letter, swore it was her, said it had to be. Heard she was in hiding all this time. I remember those rumours nearly 20 years ago. Angels above, I heard it too, but I didn't believe. Our prayers have been answered, cried an older woman who was weeping into her hands. It's finally happened, and in my lifetime. I never dared to hope, even as my brother has been jailed in Forina for 17 years. And my mother, in Stol province, they cut off her feet. Justice! Someone screamed. Justice will come to this rotting earth!
Eliza lost her footing then, nearly falling over, until Cyrus caught her and turned her firmly in his arms, hiding her face in his chest.
Please, he whispered against her hair. Please, let me get you out of here. You're not ready for this, and they're not ready for you.
You must start with the prisons, Your Majesty, another woman cried. Our brothers and sisters are treated worse than animals in the Sarut Empire and in Zeldan. They still bury the children in Shefat.
Eliza absorbed each blow, each statement gutting her, every sentence cutting deeper. These reminders of her purpose, her duty, snatching the breath from her lungs.
Does she not speak? I don't understand.
The Snudder from the castle, he said she'd spoken to him, smiled at him.
I thought he said she was here to marry the king.
Eliza gasped, her chest heaving.
Our king? King Cyrus? For months he's been preparing rooms for a bride. He's made no secret of it.
But you're sure it's her?
Servants said she arrived this morning, that she moved into the palace. Who's she with then? I can't see his face. Is that the king, do you think?
The king? In the middle of broad daylight? Someone laughed. I think not.
Here he killed Zal? In his own home?
Yes, and I heard the depraved monster deserved it. Long live King Cyrus! A voice rang out. Long live our queen!
Eliza's heart was beating too hard in her chest. She felt dangerously light-headed. She was dizzy with emotion, with panic, and plagued by a disorienting suspicion that she might be dreaming.
Eliza, please, stand up.
Eliza!
Why do they like you?
She whispered, her lips moving against his throat, even as her head filled with static.
I thought they would hate you.
Please, Your Highness, a man shouted. Say something! We beg you to speak!
Forgive me, Cyrus whispered, holding her tighter. I know you didn't want me to, but I won't wait any longer.
Cyrus, she breathed, closing her eyes against the spinning world.
I think I'm going to faint. My queen! Screamed the first woman, whose voice Eliza suspected she'd remember for the rest of her life.
My queen! You finally! She gasped,
still sobbing hysterically.
You finally come for us, after all this time!
Quite suddenly, they disappeared.